This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 2016 has been a tough year for Charlotte. HB2 brought some negative attention to our city and state, but it also cost us hundreds of millions of dollars as performers canceled shows and major sports pulled championship games. Very quickly, our image in the minds of many outsiders changed from one of the progressive New South to something more closely resembling that of the old. Then, the shooting by CMPD of Keith Scott led to a week of protests, which sometimes turned violent, set against the sparkling backdrop of uptown Charlotte. Again, we received unwanted attention in the national media, including mentions by the presidential candidates. Charlotte has worked for years to be a player on the national stage. How badly have these things damaged that effort? How do we reestablish the image of a welcoming city open for business and on the move, a city that is a great place to live for everyone? And most importantly, how do we correct the systemic problems revealed by the recent unrest in our streets? This hour, we look into that with two of the people who, as heads of major organizations representing Charlotte businesses, will have to play a role in moving this city forward. But first, we hear from Charlotte Observer business reporter Eli Portillo. Welcome back, Eli. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You are here for a number of reasons, but one of them is the fact that you were at the recent Charlotte Chamber of Commerce retreat in Asheville last week, where former Bank of America Chairman CEO and Hugh McCall and others, including former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, told business leaders here that things cannot return to normal. Were their comments unexpected?
Well, I think after the hits that you've listed that Charlotte's image has taken, that the city has endured over the past month or so, and further back, counting HB2, there's really been a sort of growing recognition that this isn't business as usual in Charlotte. Still, I think the specific content of those comments, and especially coming from two people of such stature in Charlotte, real quote-unquote fathers of the city, if you look back at it that way, really did make an impression on a lot of the people there I spoke with afterwards.
There are a lot of newcomers to Charlotte who don't know who Hugh McCall is. They may have heard his name mentioned a long time ago as president of, and CEO of Bank of America, but they have no idea who he is. Put him into context. And Harvey Gantt as well.
Well, Hugh McCall, as the CEO and chairman of NCNB, Nations Bank, really engineered the rise of Bank of America and played a pivotal role in putting the city on a national stage when it comes to business. Also played a large role in a lot of the civic decisions that were made here, and still carries a huge amount of weight in terms of prominence and respect. Harvey Gantt was the city's first black mayor, elected in 1983, and I think in a lot of people's minds really symbolized Charlotte's transition from Old South to New South without the large race riots that rocked a lot of other metro areas, and without too much violence and tension in the community. That was something that people really looked at that set the city apart.
So here's what Hugh McCall had to say. Here's how he opened his remarks to that chamber meeting.
This is the most important chamber meeting this city has ever held. The truth of the matter is we have had our hand forced, and we've been forced to look at ourselves and to look at what we haven't done well. And no matter how much we've tried, we've failed at this stage. And so we have to figure out the way forward from here. If we just mouth platitudes and think everything's going to be fine, it's not. And so we need to come away with a plan.
So did it surprise you? Is that why you went to hear Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt and some of the sports leaders in this town as well? You knew this was on the agenda when you went there to cover this meeting?
Yes, and I think it was very fortuitous timing that the lineup of speakers really opened with men who could comment on the city's rise, prominence, and where we go from here with the historical perspective that Mr. Gantt and Mr. McCall have. Certainly made the meeting a little bit less dry than they can be when they focus on things like economic incentives.
We'll hear from Harvey Gantt a little bit later on in the program, but either Harvey Gantt or Hugh McCall mentioned the Charlotte way. We've heard that phrase bandied about in the last couple of weeks a lot, and it's been printed in the newspaper a lot. A lot of the anger and frustration that we experienced during the recent protests here and around the country, and part of the anger and frustration that you're seeing exhibited in this election, I think, stems from America's original sin. We have never addressed racism. We have never addressed how we have treated black people historically, here or anywhere else in this country. But at least in Charlotte, we have this image of ourselves as handling it the Charlotte way. Are we just kidding ourselves?
Well, I think that that is one of the questions that Mr. Gantt and Mr. McCall raised at the meeting. It seems that the Charlotte way, this, I think I called it in the newspaper, a semi-mythical aura of cooperation, civil dialogue, and civic engagement, really hasn't solved these underlying problems. If you look at economic indicators, Charlotte was ranked last out of 50 large metro areas for economic mobility. A child born poor in Charlotte is unfortunately more likely to remain in the lower fifth of economic income distribution than in other major cities. And the Charlotte way, how real it is or not, you know, I can't really comment on that, well, but it hasn't solved these underlying problems.
And the Charlotte way, I think, refers a great deal to the civil rights era when civic leaders, business leaders primarily, decided it would be bad for business if we didn't open the doors of opportunity, at least the doors of restaurants and restrooms and water fountains to African Americans who had been blocked historically from doing that. And we did it because business people, white business people, said this can't continue, and we will make this happen, and they did. And therefore, we didn't have some of the unrest that the other Deep South cities had. But James Ferguson, during our public conversation last week, said we are kidding ourselves. If we think there wasn't unrest, just look back to Dorothy Counts, who was the first black woman to go to an integrated school here, and the troubles that she had walking the first morning into the schoolhouse. Did you get the impression that these two leaders, Harvey Gantt and Hugh McCall, were somewhat taken off balance or off guard by what happened during the riots and protests?
I think they were fairly clear about that. Mr. Gantt said that he was surprised to see what was happening on TV and that he would have thought before that that this wasn't something very likely in Charlotte, probably because of that legacy of the Charlotte way. But a lot of the folks who I talked with were less surprised by the events and more surprised by the fact that there was so much anger in Charlotte that they, quite frankly, were unaware of. One gentleman, a real estate developer, said, "We don't know our whole city." And he was referring, I believe, to the people in attendance at the chamber retreat and kind of pointing to a disconnect that's emerged between the image of Charlotte as this glittering New South, fast-growing, progressive city, and the reality that many people have been left behind and are not participating fully in the city's economic resurgence.
The Charlotte Observer's Eli Portillo was at this event, the chamber retreat in Asheville, merely as an observer for the Observer. But Bob Morgan was there as the organization's president and CEO. He's one of the people who will now have to heed or not heed Hugh McCall's admonition that we cannot return to business as normal in the wake of the Keith Scott shooting and the anger that it revealed. Bob Morgan is here in our Spirit Square studio along with another business leader, Michael Smith, president and CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
You're welcome. Part of that meeting was devoted to HB2, not just to the civic unrest. Was the plan originally to bring the chamber together in this retreat and talk about HB2, but then this other thing broke out and you had to address that as well?
Mike, the agenda, the lineup of speakers, which was rather remarkable, was actually put together over the months leading up to the retreat. Eli used the word fortuitous. It was the right panel of speakers to talk about both of these subjects, frankly. The sports executives talked about the tremendous impact that HB2 has had on them and on sporting events, and It all came together from a timing perspective pretty well. The governor was a part of the conversation, and so HB2 was a big part of that dialogue.
Neither of these events was your making. You had nothing to do with it. HB2 was a government situation that was brought upon us, and the other just kind of unfolded because of a systemic problem that we have with policing and with relationships between police and the African-American community, not just here, but throughout the country. But when something like this puts a city that you've worked so hard to develop an image for, and I think it's a pretty accurate image, at least in terms of how beautiful it is here, what a great place to live it is, etc., then you throw this other stuff up there on the national television. What is that? What's the thought that goes through your minds as two people who have been involved in promoting this?
Well, it's complicated that we are a city that the national image of who we are, I think, is accurate. I think you're absolutely correct. But there's many layers to a city, and there's a national dialogue that's going on right now about issues of LGBT rights, and there is a lot that's going on around race relations and a group of people that have been left behind. And it's playing out in Charlotte in a real way because we have become a purple state, the new Ohio in the national electorate, you know, a state that's going to play a really important role in balance of power, maybe in the White House. And these are issues that are being dealt with in meaningful ways across our country. I think it's actually an opportunity for Charlotte to take this on in an aggressive way and it kind of become the city we're going to become. I mean, these are things that we have to face head on.
I mean, aside from the fact that when you looked at the protests on national television, Uptown Charlotte looked like a jewel box. And it was kind of anachronistic. It was almost like whiplash. You're seeing all this rioting in the street, and it was only, 300 people, 400 people? It wasn't thousands and thousands of people.
Across three blocks.
That's right, across three blocks. But you don't know that if you're living in L.A. or someplace like that.
We all got lots of calls from relatives concerned.
Exactly right. But we looked like a jewel box last night during the Panthers' unfortunate game. We looked like a jewel box.
We're ready for a win.
But when you see this happen and when you see HB2 and what people begin to think about North Carolina and about Charlotte, because they don't separate the fact, they don't separate us from North Carolina, has it done significant damage?
Mike, it's created a whole lot of noise that is unfortunate, that makes our jobs harder. I think it's important to note, and forgive me, I'm going to sound like the cheerleader here, but Charlotte's economy has not shut down. We've seen in the first half of this year almost 5,000 jobs created ahead of last year's pace. I think it's important to focus on two things. One, the basic blocking and tackling of economic development. We have a brand, Charlotte USA. We have to continue to sell it. Michael's organization, our organization, the Charlotte Regional Partnership, we still have a cost of living that's 93% of the national average. We have a workforce that's large. It's one of the fastest growing in the country, increasingly diverse. We have an airport that's the fifth busiest in the country and gives us connectability. So we have to continue to sell those things. Companies are still talking to us. We're still landing projects. And we have to sell what those assets are. We also have to answer the questions honestly when people ask, what in the heck is going on in Charlotte, whether it's HB2.
Okay, you tell me. I'm calling you from Chicago. What the hell is going on?
Well, in terms of HB2, there's a problem in need of a fix, and we're going to continue to work on that fix. Charlotte is a city that has tried to do the right thing, went further than the legislature was willing to go. We're not going to see any change until after the election, but we're not going to give up on bringing about a fix to that problem. As it relates to the issues of the shooting and the response, it's about economic empowerment. I mean, we can talk about it. What are we going to do about it? And if we face up to that, maybe we can become a best practice for other cities.
I'm going to let the Observer's Eli Portillo chime in on this, but in just a moment, we have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service. Emerald ash borer is destroying ash trees in the Carolinas and is headed here. Ash tree owners can learn about EAB and prepare to protect and keep ash trees healthy. Tree guidance at heartwoodtree.com. And Bojangles, featuring the pork chop biscuit, a seasoned grilled pork chop on a made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit. Bojangles, serving the Carolinas since 1977. Pat McCrory and Roy Cooper face off in a gubernatorial debate tonight. It's a tight race. We analyze what is going to be said tonight and how this matchup may or may not affect the outcome of the election on this program tomorrow at 9. Summer's over, and so our summer music contest is over too. But Sarah D'Elia from WFAE News and Charlotte Talks producer Chris Miller have put together a look back at our summer showcase of listener covers of the Charlotte Talks theme, and you can take a listen anytime you want. Charlotte Talks page at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm show, Donald Trump signals he could retaliate against Republicans who withdraw support for his campaign. Ongoing outrage over his lewd comments on videotape, Trump's defiant campaign strategy, and what's ahead for his divided party.
You can join the Diane Rehm show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Bob Morgan, who is the president and CEO of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce, Michael Smith, president and CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners, and Eli Portillo, business reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who was in attendance at the recent Charlotte Chamber meeting in Asheville, where Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt and all of the leaders of the major sports enterprises spoke about the recent troubles we have experienced, both with unrest in the streets and with HB2, and how it has affected our national image and our ability to attract business and keep the businesses who are here happy and productive. Eli, you wanted to chime in on all of this.
Yes, I think the most difficult thing with the perception issue, the image issue, is really knowing how that translates to a real impact. We've had some businesses like PayPal most prominently cancel expansions here in Charlotte and North Carolina. We've also had high-profile sporting events like the NBA All-Star Game and the ACC Football Championship Game pull out. But I think the softer aspect of that, what this does in people's minds outside of Charlotte, is really tough to pin down. I was in San Francisco and Seattle recently, and just getting an Uber and going to the airport, having conversations with the Uber drivers. You know, where are you from? Oh, Charlotte, North Carolina. What's going on there? I've heard some crazy stuff. And I was in New York a couple weeks ago after the Keith Scott shooting protests. And on the front page of New York Times is a large picture of a man sprawled out dead in front of the Omni on Trade Street. Right. And I think it's really tough to figure out how that translates to dollars, but there is definitely a changing perception in the minds of people who are paying attention.
And I got a text from a friend on the Wednesday of the protest saying, it is now clear that you live in the most racist, homophobic state in the nation.
Well, and we know that's not true about our city.
We know that.
And
that's my point.
And Eli, there's been another perverse effect of all this. We've had three companies who've moved to Charlotte. They don't want to tell anybody. They don't want to draw attention to themselves. And just a perverse result. The other impact you worry about is what list are we not on? What projects are at the beginning that just automatically take a look at, five cities or 10 cities, and because of all of this, Charlotte doesn't make the list. That's a risk in recruiting companies. It's certainly a risk for Tom Murray and the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority in trying to land conventions and meetings.
And what talent? I think that's also a very quiet one of who's graduating from school now, who's thinking about changing cities that would have come to Charlotte and thinks, you know what, I'm not sure that aligns with my values.
Yeah. Prior to HB2 and prior to the unrest, we knew that Charlotte had a social capital problem. We're fairly segregated outside the workplace. And we've been talking about that for years. And then recently, and Eli mentioned this a little while ago, that we rank 49th, I think, out of the top 50 cities in terms of upward mobility, so that if you are born poor in Charlotte, the likelihood of your getting ahead economically in your lifetime is practically nil. That statistic predates the riots. What was your reaction to that at the business level, and were you planning to address that? Can that be addressed by business?
Well, that's a dialogue that the city and the county and business leaders and others, the Economic Empowerment Task Force, have been hard at work, and many of us have been a part of that dialogue. So I think there was a seriousness about that being a priority before the shooting happened. I think now, if that's not priority number one and we don't know what the next five priorities are, then we've missed the opportunity. It's embarrassing to be 50th out of 50. Mm-hmm. It is also a fact that when I meet with my counterparts from around the country, every city in America is dealing with this issue of uneven prosperity, the issue of unresolved race issues that you mentioned earlier. We're not in it alone. I think the opportunity we have, and maybe I'm guilty of the Charlotte way, let's face up to the issue. Let's take it on as a challenge. Mm-hmm. Let's get deadly serious about the recommendations that are going to come out of the Economic Empowerment Task Force, the expectations and the need for them to really deliver a coherent plan, as Hugh McCall mentioned, is very high. Let's be serious about that. In the meantime, there's some small steps we can take. We've got a bond issue, the city of Charlotte, on the ballot, $215 million or so this fall. Those dollars disproportionately to be spent in what's called the Crescent, transportation, housing, and neighborhoods, part of a 10-year plan, a $1 billion investment by the city. It's not sexy in the wake of these issues, but the city of Charlotte can vote to make those investments. The voters of Charlotte can make those investments to help try to bring infrastructure to parts of the city that have been left behind in terms of prosperity.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution held its nose for a moment and wrote about us, unfortunately, because they said, while the economy in Charlotte seems to work for a large part of the population, it has not been spread equally throughout the African-American community. And as you pointed out, Bob, that's probably true everywhere in the country. But why? Do we understand why? Because if you're going to fix it, it seems to me you have to understand why.
Well, we're waiting for the Economic Empowerment Task Force. They were scheduled to release findings, not recommendations, but findings. I think that must have been March. Delayed as a result of the shootings. It's early childhood development, preschool development. It's things like tackling the issue of early pregnancies. It's a lot about education and talent development. You know, Charlotte, we've done a strategic plan recently that has indicated we know that we've been successful at attracting talent from elsewhere. We do so disproportionately at a higher level than cities we compete with, which suggests that we run the risk, if the spigot gets turned off, as Michael suggested, what if that talent stops coming? Mm-hmm. We don't develop the talent, the organic talent, the potential that's already here. That's a question of our K-12. It's a question of community colleges. I think you'll see a strong emphasis on talent development, on early childhood development, and things like pregnancy, tackling
there was challenge. There was a challenge by some people protesting that perhaps the way to address this and to be heard was to have an economic boycott of Uptown Charlotte and South Park and essentially white businesses by African Americans, by the African American community. That has not materialized yet. But would it be fair? How would you, as the head of Charlotte Center City Partners, characterize the Uptown Charlotte workforce? Is it integrated? Is it segregated? Do African Americans and other people of color have an equal opportunity at higher paying jobs as everyone else?
I think that Uptown Charlotte and our central business district is fully integrated. And I think that there is great diversity across this workforce. I think the voice that we're hearing is what Harvey Gantt referred to as those that have been left behind. Mm-hmm. And there is great diversity in business ownership and in the workforce itself, both mm-hmm. internationally and our local diversity.
And during the break, I think it was you, Bob, who said that – maybe it was you, Michael – that Harvey Gantt makes mention of the fact in your retreat that he looked out on the protesters and didn't recognize – most of the faces, and those are the people who have been left behind.
There's some real anger out there, and I wondered if we were going to be able to address this anger in the Charlotte way. And I think we have to do a deep dive on figuring out how we resolve, if not all of the anger, a good part of why people are struggling the way they are. And it can't be our normal way of doing it.
But the facts are, with all the money and effort we've thrown at the schools, we're still struggling. And we're still struggling with housing, adequate housing, and we're really struggling with jobs. And so what I think that we ought to try to do, those of us in the chamber and in the business community, are jobs and housing. And then we work, and we continue to work on education.
That's Hugh McCall, who followed Harvey Gantt there in that clip. Let's talk about schools first before we talk about some of the things Mr. McCall said. Our public schools have resegregated. We were once, despite the fact that we didn't really want to integrate schools, once we did it, we trumpeted to the world how well we did it, and evidently we were a shining star in the nation in terms of how we did it. And when the court said, you don't have to do that if you don't want to anymore, we stopped. And we have resegregated the schools. What is the impact today? And if we don't do something about it, what will the impact be in 10 years?
Well, the hard part is we've got a basis of discriminatory housing policy that created pockets of poverty throughout our community.
What do you mean by a basis of discriminatory housing policy?
Well, I mean, we've got a system of housing across a lot of the Southeast that created these pockets of African-American neighborhoods and of poverty. And then
explain it. What is the system? You're saying it was deliberate.
Well, I mean, there is inside deeds in housing in certain Charlotte neighborhoods that preclude African-Americans.
Still today?
People still are having to turn it over and make those changes on their deeds.
Because that was, in fact, the case
in Myers Park. It's not enforced.
Right.
But that set this footprint of the pattern of neighborhoods in our community. And then we expect our school system to address that when you've got these great concentrations of poverty. And that's – you can't put this on the police. You can't put this on the school system to address when it's something this broad and this systematic.
Yeah. And CMS is discussing their magnet plan now and how they're going to do student assignment. I believe they're actually talking
tonight.
About that at tonight's meeting. And that's certainly an issue that's gotten a lot more attention and urgency in the wake of these protests.
But magnets are a Band-Aid. They work to a certain degree, but they are a Band-Aid to address this issue. Is there can you solve this issue, or is this just baked into what we've become over the last 150, 200 years, and it's going to take another 150, 200 years to get out of it?
And Mike, if the challenge is not hard enough, our country is experiencing polarization unlike we've seen in a variety of ways. We're seeing it play out in the presidential election, and you see it play out when there's talk of around pupil assignment, of trying to do things to more broadly integrate the schools. You find suburbs that start talking about pulling away from Charlotte,
right.
let's form our own municipalities. And so these challenges of polarization are not just limited to issues of race. It's broader than that. And pupil assignment, the stakes are very high, and the answers are tough to find.
But does economic mobility begin with education? If you don't have an education, you are not moving up the ladder. Is that where it begins?
I think it does, and I'm no expert on the subject, but you think about, again, the issue of pregnancy, and I'm way out of my lane here because
okay.
That's not my core competency in terms of understanding and fixing. But an individual, a young woman who has an early pregnancy, unplanned, not only limits her ability to go maximize her potential in terms of a career, but oftentimes the child then comes into the world with disadvantages that are sometimes impossible to overcome. And so, you know, can you finish that high school degree? Can you get some post-secondary education? We know in America it is simple. The more education you have, the more money you're going to earn over your lifetime.
But I'm not going to discount that, Bob, but that is young girls. There are young men who are facing a lack of economic mobility, and they don't have those child care issues.
Well, and many of them are the children of young mothers again, who were not able to give them some of the same advantages that many others come into the world with.
So I know that this is a multifaceted problem that will have to be dealt with by lots of different sectors of our society, but the business sector got together and talked about this openly and first. So what do you see as your role? Because as you say, this is out of your wheelhouse. This is not what business people talk about. What do you do?
Well, I think what's so vexing about this problem is it doesn't rest with one organization. It doesn't rest just with the county or just with the city or the chamber or the United Way. It is multifaceted. So this is going to be one of those that, to your point, is not going to be a three-year initiative. This is going to be a new horizontal through which a lot of Charlotte initiatives need to be tested and need to be understood. And we need to decide as a community through many conversations, how are we going to address something this systematic collectively?
And at the meeting last week, Hugh McCall made some recommendations or suggestions to other business leaders. He called for people to intentionally hire more CMS graduates without post-secondary or without secondary education. He called on people to hire more minority job candidates and have apprenticeship programs to deliberately hire people from these poorer or less advantaged areas in Charlotte. And he pointed to those as areas where businesses can step up. I think the key is there going to be any organized effort to do this, or are we going to see people attempt this one at a time?
How can business do that? I mean, will that not negatively impact business? You want to attract the best people that you can get if you're a business owner for the least money that you have to pay, but nonetheless, you'll pay what you have to get a great person. But if you have a person who has not finished high school, what are you supposed to do?
Well, there are some companies who are doing mentorships and job-ready programming in the high schools, the low-income high schools. Hugh McCall talked about that, the work that Red Ventures is doing, that he challenged every other employer in town. Why are all of you not providing similar opportunities?
Is Charlotte Center City Partners, is the chamber willing to hire people who are not college graduates?
Well, the chamber is a very small employer. There's a role for us to play as a connector. There's a role for us to play as a promoter. We represent 3,000 businesses. If every business would provide one mentorship within their company, you're talking about 3,000 youths who can be affected. There is definitely a role for us to play as a convener at the table. In this case,
is there a willingness?
Providing jobs.
Have you detected a willingness on the part?
Any doubt at the retreat. There was a strong receptivity to what we heard from Hugh McCall and Harvey Gannon to others.
Apprenticeships can play a huge role. The work that Ron Leeper does on the west side with his construction firm and pulling other subs into creating those kinds of jobs. There's great examples in Boston as they built out new extensions of their transit system. Each neighborhood they'd go through, they would provide an introduction to the kinds of jobs that build the transit system, and those internships and apprenticeships were made available. There's opportunities in the public sector as well.
In the Observer article that Eli wrote about your retreat, he quoted Hugh McCall, who pointed to inequalities in jobs, incomes, and housing, especially in the face of gentrification. We're dealing, he said, with prejudices that take the form of not caring. Do you agree with that? We don't care? We haven't noticed?
I don't disagree with that, but I think the problem goes deeper. Let's talk about HB2 and its impact on the hospitality and tourism industry. Yeah. And jobs that for many people are entry level or they're second jobs that allow people to survive. When you cancel a football game in Bank of America Stadium, hundreds, maybe thousands of people, money is taken out of their pocket, money that they need. And so it's a challenge. We need a fix to HB2.
Have you told that to the legislature?
Oh, absolutely.
And what's their reaction?
You know, HB2 is an interesting thing. I liken this situation to the beginning of the Civil War when people in the North and South were going to parades to celebrate the fact that the country was going to war. It took 4 years and 500,000 dead Americans later for people to bring it to a conclusion. Nothing's going to happen between now and the election. Hopefully, when we get the election behind us, we can sit down and see if the landscape has created an opportunity for people to agree. We have a problem here and we need a solution.
I want to come back and talk about affordable housing and a comment I saw in the paper this morning that we don't really need affordable housing. We need low-income housing, which is different. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in South State Bank, a community bank with strong Southern roots since 1934, focusing on commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Information available at southstatebank.com. And Donald Hack Diamonds hosting an engagement ring and wedding band trunk show featuring parade designs and other designers Thursday through Saturday, October 20th through 22nd at Moorcroft Village, South Park. Details at donaldhack.com. Donald Trump signals he could retaliate against Republicans who withdraw support for his campaign. The ongoing outrage over his lewd comments on videotape, Trump's defiant campaign strategy, and what's ahead for his divided party. The topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. We're talking about Charlotte and how to recover from our recent problems, and you can join that conversation. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Get to us on Facebook or through Twitter.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Let's go now to Haiti, where Hurricane Matthew landed Tuesday as a Category 4 storm.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Putney says CMPD is committed to other steps, like issuing body cameras to all tactical officers, as well as those on patrol or working off-duty assignments.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Bob Morgan is here, President and CEO of the Charlotte Chamber. Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer, and Michael Smith, President and CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners. Affordable housing, it's been a problem here for a long, long time. We also call that workforce housing. This is housing that is for people who are police officers and school teachers and people who work for a living but don't make a lot of money, and Charlotte has priced them out of the market, but they need to live in or near this place in which they work. So we have a dearth of that affordable housing. And I read in the paper this morning that one person said we need low-income housing, not affordable. We need because of the gentrification that we're seeing going on in places like Cherry and Wesley Heights. Now, municipalities around North Carolina cannot control this, I'm told. You cannot pass a law in the city of Charlotte that says you must have X amount of affordable housing, because the legislature has to make that decision, and we all know how the legislature feels about cities making their own decisions. Only the state can do that. But we have had in place incentives for builders to keep some of their units in the affordable category. And the last I talked about this on the program, I think only one builder out of, I don't know how many builders we have here, lots, only one has taken advantage of that. Well, if the business community is going to play a role in that, isn't that part of the role?
Well, you're referring to the density bonus, which the city allows builders and developers to build more units if they include some as income-restricted units. That hasn't really proven effective in the last several years in incentivizing those units. Developers I've talked with said it's not enough of an incentive to make the complications and the more complicated financing structures that they need to make those deals work worthwhile. So I was at City Council last night, and LaWanna Mayfield, council member who often talks about affordable housing and low-income housing, said that she's going to keep pressing this issue and trying to find ways to incentivize developers to include more units. But that's really tricky because right now, with the strength of Charlotte's apartment market, you can build market-rate units all day long, lease them up, make a lot of money. It's really tough to come up with an incentive that makes building low-income units more attractive than just building market-rate units.
Because particularly in Uptown, because in Uptown we have an unlimited density. So there is no density bonus. This doesn't apply to Uptown because that's already been given. Mm-hmm. That was part of our strategy decades ago to incent more dense development Uptown.
And the business of business is business, and the business of business is to make money, either for the owners or the stockholders, and certainly for the employees so they can pay their employees. So how can you put this – it's a burden. It would be a burden because you're taking away revenue, potential revenue, to ask these people to build less productive housing in terms of the bottom line. How can you put that burden on business?
Well, I think you have to face up to some of the policy challenges, and inclusionary zoning is one of those issues that needs to be discussed. I'm a broken record here, Mike. I've mentioned it already. On the ballot this November, $15 million in city bonds for housing, $55 million for neighborhoods. Seems like a small amount of money. This is part of a 10-year investment in our community. No tax increase is required. We need to pass these bonds, among other things, to help address the issue.
Eli.
So City Council voted last night as one of their steps to addressing the issues that have been raised in the wake of the Keith Lamont Scott shooting to bump up their goal of building or preserving 5,000 affordable housing units from a 5-year goal to a 3-year goal. I think it's kind of unclear how they're going to reach that. The preserving portion of that goal means that they can count affordable units that aren't demolished and replaced towards that goal. And they also, people need to know that the city doesn't directly go out and build affordable housing or low-income projects. They can partner in developments and finance them from the Housing Trust Fund, help in that aspect, but they're still going to need private developers to meet this goal of 5,000 affordable units.
The way this is addressed in other communities is through inclusionary zoning. Our peer cities up and down the East Coast and the West Coast use this as a way where it is priced into the value of the land. So it falls right in line with the stack of what it takes to create the assets necessary and then the money that needs to be raised to create the product. But it's a baseline that's created. Right now, we don't have that ability to do that. It's not going to happen naturally.
You don't have that ability. Why?
It's not a right that's given to our cities.
Is that something that needs to be talked to with the legislature? I mean, shouldn't that be something that cities should be able to do on their own? Because every city in North Carolina is completely different from the other. We are not Rockingham.
I think that's absolutely true. And whether it's inclusionary zoning or something else, we need a tool that makes it easier for us to be able to create more workforce and affordable housing closer.
How likely is that to happen when the request would come from the great state of Mecklenburg that is already incredibly disliked by the legislature, in which the governor says we have to repair a relationship with, when it's the legislature who's been going after us since they tried to take the airport? How likely are they to do anything?
Mike, I think that's getting the cart before the horse. We don't have consensus here locally first.
Okay.
We need to build consensus. If that's going to be the answer, we need to rally a consensus right here in Charlotte, and then we take our chances with the legislature. We don't have any other option.
It has to become a business issue for it to work. And there's a book called The Great Inversion that talks about how much of our workforce is being pushed out to the exurbs and how it's getting harder for them to get to work. And as it becomes more of a priority of getting your hospitality workers, your clerical workers, your middle income to work and having to travel less distance.
I want to go back to HB2 and the conversation I'm sure both of you have had with people in the legislature about the economic impact, not the moral issue, not the social issue, not the bathroom part of this, just the fact that when you cancel the ACC All-Star Weekend and you lose $100 million, much of that $100 million is coming out of the pockets of vendors. Small vendors who sell hot dogs and Cokes in the stands and things like that. These are small people who don't make a lot of money. When you tell the legislature that, what has been their – I know nothing's going to happen until after the election, but what has been their reaction?
There is not sympathy from the majority of the legislature for the losses that we have suffered.
Why not?
This is an issue – that talk about polarization, it looks so different from other parts of the state than it does from here.
Well, that's what the governor told you. He said if you go to Shelby, their attitude about this is completely different. But that's a moral outlook. This is an economic outlook.
Well, it's more than just the vendors at sporting events. We had a corporate CEO whose company has relocated recently on day two of the retreat, who said had contracts not been signed and the office upfit been underway, he would not have relocated his company to Charlotte. These are very high-paying jobs.
But what you're telling me is that there is no sympathy for the small guy who's being hurt economically.
Mike,
not only here,
Democrats
but in Greensboro,
in Charlotte have played to their base, and they feel like they have
But this is affecting people in Cary. It's affecting people in Greensboro. It's affecting the image of the state of North Carolina in the nation as a whole. And you're telling me that the legislature doesn't care about the little guy getting hurt economically because of a decision they made?
I think we are dealing with an incredible urban versus rural, blue versus red divide. And I think the majority of legislators, we talk about economic empowerment right here in Charlotte. There's a whole lot of the rest of our state. They've lost textiles, tobacco, furniture, their industries. There's a hostility toward the prosperity that they see in Charlotte and in Raleigh.
What was the economic engine? You take us away, what do they got?
We're looking for the empathy to that argument, Mike, and we're going to have to get the election behind us before we have a chance to make that case.
And when the governor tells you that this HB2 issue looks different to people in Shelby, which he told you at your retreat, is not the obvious answer. We didn't ask anybody in Shelby to do anything. We just asked Charlotte to do it. And if Charlotte disagrees with the decision of the city council will get voted out of office. Why are you messing with us?
You're asking me to answer for the governor. I'm not going to do that. We live in a state that where the state happens to have incredible power vis-a-vis cities and counties.
Right.
And if the legislature wants to affect Charlotte's ability to pass an ordinance, they have that power. We have to make the case that there has been real economic damage, not just to Charlotte, but to the rest of the state. We have to keep making that case.
Which was worse for the city's reputation and bottom line? And I'll ask Michael this question first because I know he has to leave. Was it HB2 or was it the recent protests?
Boy, it hit us in different ways. HB2 echoes longer and I think has been painted as more of a specific North Carolina issue, and we're the engine of the state. So, you know, in a national election, it's probably played out harder.
And as Bob just said, there's resentment to the fact that we are the engine of the state. Do you even understand that? Is that conceivable to you as an intelligent, sentient being?
You know, you paint this with politics and the balance and power across the state and people that are career politicians. The hardest part of this is both sides of HB2 paint themselves as being on the right side of history.
Right.
And that's why it's so hard to find common ground to get this resolved.
I know that you have to leave because you have a meeting to go to at 10 o'clock. So Michael Smith, CEO and president of Charlotte Center City Partners, thank you for being here. I appreciate it. Bob, same question. Which hurt us more, HB2 or the recent unrest?
I don't know how you separate the two. Both have been harmful. Mm-hmm. Actually, not to get too philosophical about this, but I think part of what we're dealing with, and we talked a little bit about this between the break, there's incredible change in society, and not all of us have the same capacity to keep up with that change as others. And I think that's a big part of what we see when you go to other parts of the state where this issue looks 180 degrees different than it does to those of us who are here in Charlotte.
At one point in our city's history, business leaders were the city's leaders. Hugh McCall, Ed Crutchfield from First Union, Rolf Neal from Knight Ritter back then. I guess it was Knight Ritter back then, The Observer. Bill Lee from Duke Power, John Belk from Belk Stores, and others would come together. They would discuss problems. They would pie in the sky. They would say, well, there's the story that was in The Observer years ago about Hugh McCall standing in the tower and saying, right there, that's where the baseball stadium is going, and by gosh, that's where it is today. And we have an email here from Jorge on Facebook. For all the work that Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt did for Charlotte, they never handed off the baton. We have not had any leaders like them. Why is it that Mr. McCall, 15 years after his retirement, is the one still addressing the Chamber of Commerce? Where are the leaders? Can we have this kind of top-down leadership anymore? Or are there leaders emerging from the bottom up?
Well, one thing that Mr. Gantt said that was interesting is that when he was mayor, he felt that he could get every important leader in the city in a room in 2 hours if there was a crisis.
Yes.
And that's not the case anymore. Excuse me. The city is much larger. It's much more complex. And the businesses that we have aren't the quote-unquote two rich uncles of the banks. Bank of America's CEO has an office in Charlotte, has a Charlotte phone number, but spends much of his time outside the city. Duke Energy has grown tremendously, has national and international concerns. And just with a large population, a much more diverse business community, it's, I think, somewhat unrealistic to expect three or four business leaders to emerge. And it also probably is not what the city and the people who are in the streets protesting want right now. One thing that a business leader said at the chamber retreat was, we can't just go down to the community and deliver these solutions like they're coming from on high. You know, the people who are protesting in the street, connecting via Facebook Live, Twitter, Instagram, social media, Periscope, live streaming things, I don't think that they're very interested in pronouncements from the CEO or chairman of a large bank or energy company. That's not to say that the business community isn't going to have a very large and very important role to play here, but we are not in that same era.
And Mike, I would say there's a missing part of the urban legend there, which is that a handful of business leaders could call a handful of African American ministers. Mm-hmm. And we saw this as recently as the Rodney King incident in our country, however many years ago that was, where I was a part of a meeting of a handful of business leaders, handful of ministers. A march was planned, ended up maybe at the old Civic Center, where there was a rally and there was conversation and a letting off of the steam, if you will. There wasn't a significant Latin American population or other diversity here, certainly when you go back to the issues of the 60s and the 50s. We were smaller, and it was easier for leaders to get people to fall in line behind whatever the issue of the day was. It's going to take a whole lot more work. We don't have the business leaders who have the time and the focus in the way that Hugh McCall and others have had. We have business leaders who want to be a part of the solution, but it's not just business anymore. We're a big city, and there are many groups. It's more than a handful of ministers and more than a handful of business
leaders. And also what's disturbing, what I'm hearing you also say, is that despite the fact that we are controlled by a Republican legislature that is supposedly business-minded, because that's what the GOP has historically been about, you're going to them and saying, look, we're economically being hurt by these laws that you're passing, is falling on deaf ears.
Well, it's there are business issues and there are cultural issues, and we're caught right between them.
Shante on Twitter writes, if I hear the Charlotte way one more time, I'm going to scream. That's code for ignore and pretend it's okay. Have you heard that before?
Not that bluntly, but I think that Hugh McCall and Harvey Gantt, and I think the majority of folks in the audience last week would totally agree with
and
that.
I think Hugh McCall put it very straightforward. He said, we failed. Our hand was forced. He basically said we have not solved these issues, and perhaps there was an element of papering over and ignoring that was involved there.
That's Eli Portillo, who gets the last word, business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Bob Morgan, president and CEO of Charlotte Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And Michael Smith, who had to leave slightly early, president and CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners. Thank you all for the hour.